All right, let's talk about the hematologic system. We're going to start with anticoagulants. Your anticoagulants begin with heparin. Heparin is used in any condition that requires rapid anticoagulation. This is like your strongest of the strong. This is going to be when you need rapid anticoagulation. Next, you have your low molecular weight heparins. This is going to be your enoxaparin, your Lovenox. I feel like if you have gone to clinical at any point, you have probably given Lovenox. It is very commonly used for DVT prophylaxis as well as the treatment of DVT or PEs. We also occasionally use it for the prevention of complications from angina or heart attacks. The purpose is to prevent clotting by activating antithrombin, thus indirectly inactivating both thrombin and factor XA, which inhibits fibrin formation. If you remember back to your lectures and your med surg, there's like a multitude of processes that go into the creation of a blood clot. And so, when you're bleeding, you need a blood clot. But when you've got increased risk for any type of blood clot, especially DVTs, PEs, things like that, then these are some of the medications that we use to prevent those clots. Complications of heparin, obviously, if we're preventing you from clotting, our concern is that you are going to hemorrhage. They can also create HIT, which is heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. And then your enoxaparin, we've got the obviously the risk for the hemorrhage, but it can also cause some neurological damage if you develop a hematoma during any type of spinal or epidural anesthesia, and then the thrombocytopenia as well. We would not give this if our concern is thrombocytopenia, then obviously we're not going to give it if our patient has thrombocytopenia. And if our concern is hemorrhage, we're not going to give it to patients who have any type of uncontrolled bleeding. We also would not use this medication if our patient is going to have surgery in the eye, the brain, the spinal cord, if they are requiring a lumbar puncture or any type of regional anesthesia, and that's because of the risk of the neurologic damage. Anticoagulants are going to interact with any antiplatelet agents. That includes your aspirin, your NSAIDs, or your oral anticoagulants that we're going to talk about in just a second. These anticoagulants, this is heparin and enoxaparin, these must be given either sub-Q or IV. The GI system will basically inactivate these medications and they will have no therapeutic effect. While our patients are on this, we need to make sure we're monitoring their CBC, their platelets, and their hematocrit. If we are using heparin, it is a double verified medication. It is a high-risk medication and requires two RNs to sign off on this medication when it is administered. Next, we're going to talk about our oral anticoagulant. The one we're going to talk about is warfarin. This is what your may have heard is Coumadin. This is your Coumadin warfarin. This medication antagonizes vitamin K, preventing the synthesis of four coagulation factors, including factor 7, factor 9, factor 10, as well as your prothrombin. You do not need to know these exact things. I just want you to understand that it is an antagonizer of vitamin K. That's going to come into play in a minute when we talk about our nursing administration. This medication is used for venous thrombosis. It is used for AFib. The problem with AFib is when you think about your heart, you got four chambers. And so with AFib, your two atria are fluttering. They're just quivering. So the blood has a tendency to swirl. Anytime blood is swirling, the concern is for a clot. If that clot makes its way through the ventricle out into the lung, you have a PE, a pulmonary embolism. So we use Coumadin for patients who have AFib to prevent those blood clots from forming and making their way into the lung. We also use warfarin for patients who have had a prosthetic heart valve or have recurrent that's supposed to be MIs with a small s, myocardial infarctions, transient ischemic attacks, pulmonary embolisms, or DVT. Complications. If we're stopping the clotting factor, we're concerned about the potential for hemorrhage. Warfarin also comes with the risk for the development of hepatitis and can also create toxicity. It is contraindicated in pregnancy. It will cross and cause fetal demise. We're worried about thrombocytopenia, uncontrolled bleeding. It's an anticoagulant. We are stopping the ability of blood to clot. Same as our IV and sub-Q. We would not use it if we were having surgery on the eye, the brain, the spinal cord, if we needed a lumbar puncture or any type of regional anesthetic. All right. It is also contraindicated for vitamin K deficiency and for alcohol use disorder. Interactions. Foods that are high in vitamin K interactions include foods that are high in vitamin K. Foods that are high in vitamin K include your dark green leafy vegetables, your spinach, your what you'll find most commonly here in the South is going to be your turnip greens, your mustard greens, spinach, things like that, broccoli, Brussels sprouts. Basically, it decreases the anticoagulative effects of your warfarin. In a minute, we're going to talk about you have to monitor your PT and INR, and you adjust the dose based on what the PT INR is to maintain therapeutic levels of warfarin. So what happens is your patients, they've been steady on their warfarin, their Coumadin, they've been taking it, their levels are good, and then all of a sudden fall comes in, the mustard greens, the turnips, the, you know, whatever season they grow. I don't even know that it grows in the fall. I don't know. Anyway, whatever season it grows, it comes into season. They're everywhere and people start eating it. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, their PT and their INR is falling. And so we're upping the dose. We're giving them more Coumadin, more warfarin to try to maintain those therapeutic levels. But then the next time they come in, they're way high. Well, they only ate that mustard greens or turnip greens the one day. We adjusted their Coumadin based off of what it was after that one day. And then the next thing you know, now we've got them too thin. And so what we need to educate these patients is that they really need to avoid these foods. And if they are going to eat them, to eat very small servings of it. You know, if you just got a hankering and you just got to have your turnip greens, then, you know, just eat a spoonful. Enjoy that one spoonful and be alive. All right. Also, it can interact with your heparin, your aspirin, all of those other things that create anticoagulation effects. And then your sulfonamides also interact with your Coumadin and can increase the risk for bleeding. And then there are multiple other medications that interact with warfarin. And so we want to make sure that we do a very good med reconciliation for any of these patients to make sure that we know everything they're taking and that we can monitor for those interactions. All right. Coumadin is usually administered orally once daily, and we want them to take it about the same time every day. It comes in several different combinations. You can get a 2 milligram, you can get a 5 milligram tablet, and then they will monitor their PT and INR. If it's stable, they'll usually monitor it weekly, but if it starts to have fluctuations, then you may have to monitor it twice a week. So you can imagine how for these patients, it can become very burdensome to have to constantly come in to get their PT and INR monitored. All right, your anticoagulation can persist for up to 5 days after you stop the medication. So if your patient has got a planned surgery coming up, they will have to stop the medication at least 5 days prior to the surgery. We want to avoid alcohol. We want these patients to be on bleeding precautions. Remember, we're going to use electric razors because we don't want them using straight razors. You know, we want them to use a soft toothbrush. You know, all those bleeding precautions are going to be placed on these patients. We also want to make sure they wear a medical alert bracelet. if for some reason they pass out, they fall out, they hit their head, it is very important that we know that they're on an anticoagulant so that we can provide them with adequate care if they are unable to speak and let us know that. All right, the next class of medications we're going to talk about is antiplatelets. All right, your antiplatelets include your aspirin and it includes your clopidogrel. These are the ones that I want you to focus on. These are the ones you're going to see most frequently. And what these do is they prevent platelets from clumping together, therefore inhibiting clotting. Used in the prevention of MI. We know that a lot of our patients are going to be on a daily aspirin therapy. It prevents stroke, TIAs. It is also used in acute coronary syndrome. If a patient presents to the emergency room with chest pain, we know that we're going to provide them with 325 milligrams of aspirin. All right, complications. For aspirin, we know that it can cause some GI effects. It increases the risk for GI bleeds. We also know that it increases the risk of a hemorrhagic stroke by prolonging bleeding time. Interestingly enough, long-term use of aspirin also can cause ringing in the ears, which is tinnitus, and can also lead to eventual hearing loss. With clopidogrel, we're looking at some of those same GI effects. It is an antiplatelet, and so the complication would obviously be bleeding, from what would otherwise be considered a minor injury. Contraindicated in any bleeding disorders, in any thrombocytopenia and peptic ulcer disease, and that is because of the risk for GI bleeds. So if you have a history of peptic ulcer disease, we do not want you taking aspirin and clopidogrel because a small GI bleed on an antiplatelet can become a massive problem. Interactions include current use of any other medications that affect your bleeding time. You want to advise these patients that the prevention can be accomplished with a low dose 81 milligram aspirin. They don't have to take the big 325 milligram aspirin every day and have really thin blood and have bruises every time they even, look at their skin sideways. We want to take aspirin 325 during the initial presentation of an MI, but otherwise we can accomplish our goals with an 81 milligram. We should notify the provider regarding aspirin use. Every time you go to the doctor, you need to let them know that you are taking aspirin. Clopidogrel is occasionally prescribed concurrently with aspirin, which increases the risk for bleeding, and we know that we need to stop it 7 days before any elective surgery. Next, we're going to talk about our thrombolytics. These are going to be often referred to as our clot busters. TPA is what we typically call it, but it's alteplase. It dissolves clots that have already been formed, and so the clot is either causing an acute MI, a pulmonary embolism, a stroke, or it has basically blocked a central IV catheter. For treatment of myocardial infarction, you can use any of these three, even though I will tell you I have never seen these two actually used. I've heard of them, and they are available, but I don't know if it's a cost issue, but pretty much every hospital that I've been associated with only uses the TPA, the alteplase. All right, complication obviously is bleeding. And so every facility that I've ever worked at has a very lengthy list of patients who qualify for clot busters versus those who do not qualify. And those checklists have to be completed by the nurse and signed off by the nurse and the provider before the TPA can be administered. Contraindications for any risk for bleeding, any type of history of hemorrhagic stroke, if you've had any cerebral vascular lesions, if you have active bleeding, if you have any history of trauma, it is contraindicated for these because of the risk of bleeding. If the patient starts to bleed, it is virtually impossible to stop it after being administered TPA. Concurrent use of any other medications that enhance bleeding would be contraindicated and cause an interaction. And our nursing administration includes, if the patient meets qualification, if they pass that long laundry list checklist of who can and who cannot receive it, we want to administer it as soon as possible. Recommended is within 3 hours of the onset. That is typically with a CVA is the most common reason that we use it. We want to monitor these patients very, very closely because of this increased risk of bleeding. We want to monitor their heart rate. We want to monitor their blood pressure, monitor their labs, monitor their level of consciousness, their neuro exams. Anytime our patient is on TPA, we want to maintain a very close IV access. If we have to turn around and administer blood, we're going to learn here in just a few minutes that we need a large bore IV to administer blood. And so if our patient on TPA begins to bleed and needs to have supplemental blood transfusions, we need to make sure that we have a large bore IV access. While they're on TPA, we want to limit any venipuncture. We do not want to keep sticking them. Remember, they're not going to create a clot. And then we also want to make sure that we administer GI prophylaxis. This is going to be your protonics to help prevent any GI bleeds. The next drug we're going to talk about is your erythropoietin. This is usually epoietin alpha. It is used to encourage the bone marrow to increase production of red blood cells. It is most commonly used for the treatment of anemia in your hemodialysis chronic kidney disease patients. It can also be used for patients who are on chemotherapy that is suppressing their bone marrow, as well as your HIV patients. Complications include hypertension, the risk for blood clots, thrombolytic events, DVT, headaches, and body aches. Contraindications, we do not administer this if our patient already has uncontrolled hypertension. And for some form of cancers, we also would not administer this. When we look at our nursing administration, we want to maintain an adequate measure of their blood pressure because we cannot administer it if the patient is having uncontrolled blood pressure. Do not agitate the vial of medicine. This is not one that we're going to shake. Okay, we're gonna treat it very gingerly. We're gonna draw it up. We're gonna administer it immediately after drawing up, not put it down in our pocket where it's also getting all mixed up. We do not mix it with any other medications in the same syringe. Now, it is usually dosed 3 times a week, okay? And that kind of falls in line with what your hemodialysis patients are going to be getting hemodialysis. And so most of the time, this is gonna be administered by your dialysis staff. Monitor your iron levels. You want to make sure that the patient has adequate iron levels, and then monitor your hemoglobin and hematocrit until the target is reached. All right, now we're going to go into our blood products. The first one we're going to talk about is packed red blood cells. Packed red blood cells are literally just packed red blood cells. Okay, it increases the number of red blood cells. It is used for severe symptomatic anemia, hemoglobinopathies, and then medication-induced hemolytic anemia. The complications are going to be your transfusion reactions, as well as hyperkalemia. You can have graft versus host disease, as well as sepsis. It is contraindicated for patients who have any type of hypersensitivity to red blood cells or religious or cultural issues. There are certain religions that do not accept blood transfusions, and there are certain cultural entities that do not desire any blood products as well. So, you know, make sure that you have addressed with your patient if they want a blood transfusion. All right, along with packed red blood cells, we can also administer fresh frozen plasma. This is usually used when the patient is having a massive hemorrhage, active bleeding, burns, significant burns. We will administer the fresh frozen plasma. It can also be administered in the treatment of shock, DIC. And so complications, again, you're looking at your blood transfusion reactions, as well as your circulatory overload. Remember that plasma is the liquid portion of blood. And so if we give them this liquid, it's increasing their onboard fluid. And then it can also cause sepsis. Same thing, it is considered a blood product, so the cultural and religious issues apply as well. Albumin. Albumin is used to expand the circulating blood volume by exerting oncotic pressure. Albumin is used for hypovolemia, hypoalbuminuria, as well as burns. It is also used for patients who have undergone a cardiopulmonary bypass. The complication for albumin is going to be that fluid volume overload. Its entire purpose is to expand blood volume. If I expand blood volume too much, I end up in overload. It is considered a blood product, so it's contraindicated for patients who have religious and cultural issues with receiving blood. Now, I put the Nursing Administration of Blood Products all together. This is directly out of ATI. I highly encourage you to pay close attention to the administration of blood products. This is a very important nursing skill and something that I feel like you should know. And so I've taken this directly from ATI. I want you to read over it. Think about the why behind it. If we're going to administer blood, we should have baseline lab. All right, it's administered for several purposes, but our hemoglobin, hematocrit, platelet counts, things like that are going to be very important. Prior to the start of transfusion, you want to obtain a signed consent for the transfusion. You want to assess for the risk of fluid overload. Okay, if we are at significant risk, but we need the blood, we may have to administer a diuretic in between units. You want to obtain vital signs before, and then at 15 minutes, at 30 minutes, and then at least hourly. You will stay with this patient right by their side. You will not leave the room for the first 15 to 30 minutes. Most transfusion reactions are going to recur within the first 15 to 30 minutes of the transfusion, and that is why every hospital policy that I have ever read, known of, or worked at requires that you stay at the bedside for the first 15 to 30 minutes. You want to administer your blood products through a 20 or larger. Most facilities prefer to have an 18 gauge, but it can be done with a 20 gauge to avoid the hemolysis of the blood cells. As the blood cells are traveling down the IV tubing and entering into the body through this little, you know, if you've got a smaller, it can actually damage those red blood cells. Remember, red blood cells have a very short lifespan. And so anytime we are giving blood cells, if we want them to have those packed red blood cells, we need to keep those red blood cells intact as long as possible. All right, once you pick it up, all right, so you've got 30 minutes from the time you pick it up from the blood bank to begin the transfusion. So when you go get the blood from the blood bank, you need to have already assessed your lab values, looked over them. You should have already gotten your consent form signed, all of that stuff. When you go pick it up from the blood center, you got 30 minutes to infuse it, to get it started. All right. You've got 4 hours from refrigeration until it must be completed, Okay. Make sure you complete all the safety checks. The only thing that you will run with your blood products is normal saline, 0.9% sodium chloride. You will administer it through a line that is for blood products or a Y-type tubing. The tubing must be changed after every 2 units. Every 2 units that are administered, you must obtain new tubing. All right, if you are administering platelets, you have a special platelet filter, and the problem is that the platelets can stick to the administration filter and the tubing, and so it's very important to use tubing and a filter specifically for platelets. Make sure that you document all of your information, your start time, your vital signs, any adverse events, anything that happens. So that's first 15 minutes that you're sitting in there with the patient. That's when you're going to be doing your documentation. You know, what's going on? How's the patient feeling? How's the vital signs looking? Universal precautions. I don't have to tell you, when you're handling blood, you need to make sure you got your gloves on, you're doing your hand hygiene, you're doing your universal precautions, treat all body fluid, as if it has something. Do not mix any medications with your blood products. When you're administering blood, it is whatever product you pick up from the blood bank, and that only. Don't do any IV pushes. Don't administer, you know, any medications in the same IV catheter as your blood. All right. Blood transfusions have to be completed within a specific time. So packed red blood cells must be infused within 2 to 4 hours. Fresh frozen plasma infuses over 30 to 60 minutes. And then albumin, it depends on the percent. Okay. So you've got to make sure that you have set your pump to run at a time that will allow you to get your entire unit, which is 250 mils of packed red blood cells or 200 mils of fresh frozen plasma, in the allotted time. All right. If a transfusion reaction is going to happen, it is most likely going to happen in the first 15 minutes. If a reaction does happen, stop the transfusion and notify the provider. You are not going to turn on the IV fluids that are connected to the Y tubing. You are going to stop the Y tubing, the blood tubing, and then you're going to start a brand new set of tubing and administer normal saline through the new tubing. Document the start and the completion times of the transfusion, the volume of the transfusion, and what was the response. Stay with the client. Do not leave the client. Continue to monitor vital signs and urinary output. All right. After you have verified that the patient is stable, you will notify the blood bank. You will send the blood tubing back to the bank so that they can retest it to make sure that there were no errors in what was administered, what was labeled. You're also going to obtain a urine specimen. You want to send that urine specimen to determine if the patient is having any hemolysis through the urine. You will repeat the type and cross match, obtain a CBC and a bilirubin, and then complete the transfusion log sheet. Okay, that will end up going into the patient's record. The provider is going to come and address the treatment of the infusion. These instructions are for how you deal with the blood once the transfusion once the reaction is noted. All right, that is the end of that one. If you have any questions, let me know. That's it.